You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Tuesday, May 7th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Joe Biden spoke with eloquence and depth at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's annual commemoration of Germany's attempt to annihilate European Jews. He connected the events of the Holocaust with what Israel went through on October 7th.
That hatred was brought to life on October 7th in 2023. On a sacred Jewish holiday, the terrorist group Hamas unleashed the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. Driven by ancient desire to wipe out the Jewish people off the face of the earth, over 1,200 innocent people, babies, parents, grandparents, slaughtered in their kibbutz, massacred at a music festival, brutally raped, mutilated, and sexually assaulted.
Biden took particular care to address the many documented instances of sexual assault on October 7th. Many anti-Zionist critics spend a lot of attention trying to poke holes in the chronicled instances of rape. In fact, a collection of 50 journalism school professors are leading the denialist charge, petitioning media organizations to reconsider their reporting on the many instances of rape. Biden pledged to stand by the Jews and Israel. No matter the differences he may currently be having with Benjamin Netanyahu, he said, quote, "My commitment to the safety of the Jewish people, to the security of Israel, and its right to exist as an independent Jewish state is ironclad, even," he added, "when we disagree." This, the day after the start of Israel's military actions in Rafah, the last redoubt of Hamas, but also the last safe refuge for hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians. Reporting on the military action often noted that it occurred and began just as Hamas accepted a ceasefire deal. Here was Fox reporting this yesterday.
Just now from Reuters, we are receiving some news that Hamas saying that it has accepted a Gaza ceasefire proposal from Egypt and Qatar. Hamas said in a statement that its chief had informed Qatar's prime minister and Egypt's intelligence chief of its acceptance of their proposal.
This led to such headlines as the CBC's, "Israel launches airstrikes in Rafah as Hamas accepts mediated ceasefire deal." Left unsaid in that headline was that Hamas accepted a deal that might have been mediated by Egypt and Qatar, but it was never agreed to by Israel. Those close to the negotiations, as they're often described, say it was very close to what Israel had been wanting, but one detail or sticking point was that a pledge to return Israeli hostages became a pledge to return Israeli hostages or their remains. So Hamas accepts a ceasefire deal that Israel never put forward is somewhere in the category of Israel accepts Hamas's surrender, because neither was actually offered. That said, the U.S. administration is clearly frustrated. They thought they were close. Israeli military leadership is not terribly interested in a ceasefire at this point. And that might be disappointing, but we should note it's entirely typical of war. When one side perceives it to have a clear, and in Israel's case, a clear overwhelming tactical and strategic advantage, it's hard for them not to press the advantage to achieve military objectives, but also to get a better deal the next time. And the next time might be soon. And let's not forget, Israel is fighting a war thrust upon them, a war they feel that if they don't fight, there will be no Israel. It is not a war of choice for them. And It is an unusual war, more tunnels than we've ever seen. The tactics of one side is not to kill their enemy, but to facilitate the death of their own citizens. These strong, strong opinions of populations far from the combat zone, but those opinions also being far from uniform. So it is unusual, but it's still a war. And in war, ceasefires or surrenders don't come until both sides, both combatants, are defeated or exhausted. On the show today, we hear from an overlooked main character in the great Christy Gnome Quadruped Cull. But first, the trial of Senator Bob Menendez, now the indictment of Representative Henry Kular, undermines a permanent truth about politics. With power and influence comes an effort to influence the influence. But even with these criminal proceedings, it is useful to remember the old adage that the real scandal isn't always what's illegal. We are joined next by one of the two co-authors, a brother-brother team, of a new book about Washington lobbying, The Wolves of K Street, the secret history of how big money took over big government. Author and Wall Street Journal reporter Brody Mullins joins us next. A lot of times when you hear about VPNs, I find that they just assume you know what they are, or even if you have an understanding, oh, they're a virtual private network, you might not know the acronym, but in general, don't they mask what you do online? Why do I need that? People don't explain it correctly, and it was explained to me when I got into the beneficial aspects of Surfshark. So a VPN does mask what you do online, and that's really important for some people who, might be trying to be a dissident in an oppressive regime. It's also just important in terms of general hygiene for why do you have to let every advertiser and everyone else know where you were and, you know, follow your tracks. But I find it's also very practical. Like I said, it's a mask. And so a mask does hide identity, but a mask, a well-fitted N95 mask, also might protect you, which is what a VPN does too. Practically, however, in my life, there are many websites that when I'm traveling, I can access. I have and pay for access to them. Then I find myself in as far-flung a place as Canada. Sometimes, as an American, a foreign version of, say, Netflix would come in handy. I'd like to watch some of those shows, and I'm not just talking about Czechoslovak soap operas. I'm talking about how the excellent movies move in and out of the different Netflix in different localities. With a really good VPN like Surfshark, you could access all of them. And another big one for me is there is a major broadcaster in Britain. It is a broadcasting company there, but they don't let me hear all the stuff that someone there can hear. With a VPN, I could listen to that as if I were there. There are so many practical uses, plus the traditional use of why let them know exactly what you're doing. Your surfing is for you. A VPN allows you to surf what you want to surf, where you want to surf, without interference from, let's say, repressive governments or the Czech Netflix regime. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/gist. What are those deals? Well, enter promo code GIST for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right. 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/gist.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
So let's go to 1961. Color TV. The people we know who are running the country today, they were adults. But in 1961, a total of 130 American companies had retained a lobbyist of any kind. Of those, just 50 had offices in Washington, D.C. It was a small industry trying to extract whatever favors or concessions they could on the federal government. In fact, one study in 1964 found that of the 166 largest companies examined, only 22% had made any contact at all with Congress during the prior 2 years. Today, that's different. That's extremely different. And that is the subject of I'm going to say, surprisingly gripping new book by the brothers Brody and Luke Mullins. The name of the book is The Wolves of K Street, The Secret History of How Big Money Took Over Big Government. Brody Mullins, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Give me a sense of things. So I laid the predicate with some 1961 stats, scintillating 61 stats. What can you do to update those stats and give us a sense today of where lobbying stands?
Yeah, well, you know, you started at a pretty good point. Also, surprisingly gripping is something we should have on the book jacket. That would be a good quote yeah. for us.
You're not going to expect 600 pages of lobbying to have that much death and hookers and dwarves, but it has a lot.
Thank you, Paul Manafort.
Yeah,
that was sort of the goal. So, yeah, 1961 is a pretty good point to start because at that point, companies and corporate America was pretty happy. From the 1940s to the 50s to the 60s and into the 70s, corporate America was doing pretty well. They were making money. They were employing lots of people. They were fighting with labor unions, but they really had a pretty good relationship with labor. And then what changed is in the 1970s, inflation came, the economy tanked, there was oil shocks, and all of a sudden companies were seeing profits go down and bonuses were going down. And companies look around and said, hey, what's the problem? And they realized that for decades, government regulations were growing in Washington on clean air, on civil rights, on minimum wage, on the workday, on road safety, autos. Every single type of regulation in industry had been growing. And companies for years, when they were making money, didn't seem to mind. In fact, companies and Republicans supported lots of these regulations, unlike today. For example, the Environmental Protection Agency was created by President Nixon. I mean, you would never think that, with the support of companies. All that changed in the 70s. Once companies weren't making as much money, they saw the government as the problem. And in order to fight the government, they started hiring lobbyists. So starting in the 70s and going to now, almost every company has, I was going to say a lobbyist, almost every company has dozens of lobbyists in D.C., fighting against rules and regulations that they believe now stand in their way.
Yeah. And also, what you don't leave out in the book, but you, I think, underemphasized in that answer is what was pushing against the interests of corporations were the relative strengths of unions, and that is not the picture today.
Well, you're exactly right. One of the first things that companies did was use government rules to go after labor unions, try to push labor unions, their biggest opponent, into today where they're sort of almost non-existent. We talked to about 100 corporate lobbyists recently and said, hey, who's your biggest opponent? Who are you fighting against on Capitol Hill? And not one of them said a labor union.
Yeah. So the book is told through characters, and I think that's a good choice. It makes it propulsive, and these characters are characters, and I want to do that. But in your answer, you lay out the thesis you're emphasizing is more of macro conditions, and certain players recognize the lay of the land and they take advantage of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we wanted to start with a big macroeconomic standing. And that was, again, that the companies are doing pretty well for most of the century. They find themselves under attack. And like, any other industry or company or human, they realize that they need to fight back. And that's what happened in the 70s.
Yes. So let's start with Hale Boggs and Tommy Boggs and an old friend of mine, shouldn't get mentioned much, Cokie Roberts, but who are they and why are they so important to this story?
Yeah. So we read about four or five lobbyists over time to help tell our story of how companies became so big and powerful in Washington. But we're also talking a little bit about how lobbying has changed over the years. Tommy Boggs, we consider one of the first modern lobbyists. He played the game back when lobbying was about relationships and insider deals and cozy partnerships with members of Congress. And Tommy Boggs was the ultimate Washington insider. His dad was a member of Congress for decades, rose up in the House of Representatives to be the number two House Democrat in Congress at a time when only a few members of Congress mattered. And those were the ones at the top. When his father disappeared in a plane in the Alaskan mountains, his mom was elected to replace him. So both of his parents are members of Congress. He got summer jobs on Capitol Hill, working the elevator as an elevator operator in the House, where he got to know all the key members of Congress. He worked with LBJ and would carry LBJ's drinks out around Congress for him.
Because it didn't look good with LBJ carrying a glass of scotch around. So exactly. He gave it to the gopher, yeah.
Exactly. So when he graduated law school and decided to become a lobbyist, he knew all the key members of Congress. And in an era where lobbying was all about asking key members of Congress for favors, no one was better than Tommy Boggs. And as a result, he signed up dozens and dozens, in fact, hundreds of corporate clients would pay him millions of dollars because he had the ear of the key players in Washington.
So when he, though, signed up to be a lobbyist, graduated law school, signed up to be a lobbyist, what was he signing up to do? What was the lay of the land then?
Back then, there really wasn't much lobbying in Washington. But Tommy Boggs realized that there's two ways to fight regulations on behalf of a company. One is that you can go litigate them. You can file lawsuits against legislation or laws in federal court, which was what most companies did. Or you can go change the law. So he found friends on Capitol Hill who would simply change the law for him, or would put an amendment in a bill to make a rule or regulation go away or shift it in the benefit of a client. And so he really realized that it was a much easier and less cost, less costly way of changing the rules. And that's just using your friends on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Now, there were, I guess they wouldn't be, they weren't as professionalized, but there were always fixers and influencers. And, you know, maybe if some of us saw Boardwalk Empire, the character Gaston Means, who was played by Steven Root, he was this kind of figure. I mean, the reason that the word lobbyist exists is because these sort of creatures or constitutionally protected individuals were allowed or regulated or, you know, they have the right to lobby their and stay to lobby the public officials and, you know, to congregate in the lobby. So was it Boggs who was seeing that regulation was becoming so expansive and he saw opportunities? I guess my question is, was he just playing a tradition that has been the consummate Washington insider, maybe with some familial connections? And was he part of that tradition? He just expanded it, or was it really of a different kind?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, probably something I should have explained earlier. There had been lobbyists before Tommy Boggs. But before Tommy Boggs and before the 1970s, our government was fairly simple. You had the president. There was only a few people who could make laws or regulations. It was the president, it was the Speaker of the House, and it was the Senate Majority Leader. And when those three men, they're always men, got together, they decided what to do. So if you were a good lobbyist, you only needed to know those three people. And in fact, there were a few sort of titans of lobbying who had worked for FDR, or had worked for Eisenhower, or had worked for Truman, or worked for Carter. And they were the best lobbyists because they knew the few people who get things done. Watergate changed things. One of the things that happened in the Watergate scandal is that the American people said, wait a second, the president shouldn't have so much power. So we elected 100 new members of Congress after the 1974, or in the 1974 election. And those reformers came to Washington to try to change how the government worked. They took power from the presidency and they gave it to Congress. And they took power from the speaker, from the leaders of Congress, and made it more diffuse and in a way more democratic. They created committees and subcommittees and sub-subcommittees. And the idea was to democratize Congress so more members of Congress had power. What that meant was if you had a great relationship with the president, that didn't matter as much anymore. You needed to know Congress. And who knew Congress? Tommy Boggs. He knew the system. He knew everyone in Capitol. Yes, he knew the Speaker of the House. Yes, he knew the Senate Majority Leader. But he also knew everyone up and down the chain because he literally grew up in Congress. So all of a sudden, Tommy Boggs said, you know, I know the most important people, but I also know how the system works. Boggs had a joke. He would say that after 1974, if you went up to Capitol Hill and yelled, hey, Mr. Chairman, half the people in Congress would turn around. Because every member of Congress had a subcommittee chairmanship or a sub-panel chairmanship. Everyone was in charge of something. And no one knew better than Tommy Boggs how to manipulate that system.
Was Boggs, was his firm, Patton Boggs, was it as colorful and corrupt as some of the other firms? And we're going to get to Paul Manafort and Roger Stone and that firm. We're going to get to, I hope, the Podestas. Both of those ended in, you know, very conspicuous ignominy. I noticed that Squire Patton Boggs is still an ongoing concern. So how up to the edge of the law did he play it?
Yeah, I think, you know, he certainly was very, very colorful. And his firm was very, very colorful. I don't think that they were corrupt. They never got accused of any wrongdoing. they sort of pushed the line. But you have to think, remember this, this was back in sort of like a Mad Men era.
Yeah.
1960s, 70s, 80s. So I'm sure things that they're doing back then would be completely scandalous now. You know, it was an all-male company. It was a hard-charging, heavy-drinking sort of place. In fact, there was a every day a cart lady would push a cart around the office with bottles of alcohol, refilling everyone's personal bars in their office. Mm-hmm. Staff meetings would start with 2 hours of martinis before the staff meeting even began. So, you know, if you think of 1970s.
Must have been productive meetings. did you and your brother have a similar writing process? No,
we did not. We'd never get this done. You know, again, it was a different era back then. And, you know, their motto, the firm's motto was wins over sins, as in anything you can do to get the job done for your client. And it was a heady day. People were making lots of money. They were driving nice cars. They were, you know, dating the best looking women in Washington, having the best parties. And that's how it was back then.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I would say they did not cross the line in terms of doing anything illegal.
Yeah. So he was a scion of Democratic party power. What about the bipartisanship of him and the firm? What was his business strategy? What were his personal leanings? Did the two interact?
So Tommy Boggs went where the money was and went where the power was. And you have to remember, you know, right now things are divided on Capitol Hill. Republicans and Democrats are fighting tooth and nail. And what, you know, a member of Congress died the other day, meaning the Republican majority in the Senate is now, in the House is now 2 votes instead of 1. I mean, it's razor, razor thin. Back then, Democrats dominated everything. They had huge majorities in the House, huge majorities in the Senate. Tommy Boggs was a Democrat, and Democrats were the only thing that mattered. He didn't need to know Republicans, and therefore his firm was all Democratic. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected, and someone said to Boggs, you know, how are you going to deal with the Reagan administration, deal with all these Republicans? And Boggs, you know, without missing a beat, said, I don't know, I've never been a Republican before. You know, it just shows how quickly he can switch to, you know, whatever personally benefits him.
Yeah. Well, the answer is, as you demonstrate, there's now a market opportunity or a market inefficiency, and into it come Black, Manafort, and Stone. These are, we know the names Roger Stone and Paul Manafort. Charles Black was more the mature, and they're all young men, but I think it was described as it was comparing Charlie Black to Lee Atwater. And if one of them walked into his home and there was someone having an affair with his wife, Lee Atwater would blow up the house. Charlie Black would hand him his umbrella, tell him to be on his way, and then within a year have the guy killed. But anyway, tell me about this firm, these Republicans, their methods, how they changed the game.
Yeah, so this is the first big Republican firm of the 1980s. You know, go back to what I just said a minute ago. Democrats dominated Congress for 50 years. And if you're Republican, it didn't matter. And all of a sudden in 1980, we get a Republican president, and not just Republican president, but a Republican Senate. And there weren't any Republican lobbyists in town. There weren't any Republicans who had connections to the Republican Party, and certainly to these new officials. Charlie Black and Paul Manafort and Roger Stone were campaign officials. They had worked on Senate campaigns and on House campaigns, and most importantly, on the Ronald Reagan campaign. So all of a sudden, when Ronald Reagan wins, these three guys or four guys decided to start a firm, and they said, hey, we might as well be a lobbying firm because there's no other lobbyists out there who are Republicans. Companies all of a sudden said, oh, crap, for 50 years I've invested, or 30 years or 20 years I've invested in getting to know these Democrats. Now I have to know Ronald Reagan. Who is this guy? And who are these Republicans who are running the Senate? Who knows them? Well, the people who knew them were Charlie Black and Paul Manafort and Roger Stone. So those guys just started sucking up all the business from those big companies who needed access, who needed relationships in Congress.
Yeah, I think today we have, because two of the three people you named have been criminally adjudicated to have transgressed in pretty serious ways, I think we have a conception of these guys as, well, quasi-outs, fringe characters, let me just put it that way. And they were certainly radical, and they were certainly swashbuckling. But you paint a picture that they were the exact epicenter of the Republican establishment for at least a decade.
Yeah, it's sort of similar to what's going on right now, where there is sort of a conventional Republican Party, and there's folks who are more populist. These guys are on the more populist side, and so was Ronald Reagan. I mean, Ronald Reagan came in as a more extreme Republican than sort of the Dwight Eisenhower types that have been around before. So they were very much in line with the growing size of the Republican Party, and they had helped elect many of those members of Congress themselves. So they had very good relationships with the sort of key growing part of the Republican Party.
Were they different in how they conducted business, not just the results they wanted, but their methods than Boggs and the Democratic establishment?
They were not lobbyists. They were campaign guys. They had worked on the Reagan campaign and other campaigns. And in campaigns, what you do is you need to get 51% of voters to support your guy and you win. So all of a sudden, Reagan is elected. They're sitting around as campaign consultants. And someone, I think Paul Manafort, said, hey, maybe we should become lobbyists. And they said, you know what? That's great. We can make a ton of money as lobbyists. We have these connections. Corporations pay a ton of money. And they realized it's sort of the same idea. You just need 51% of your constituents, in this case, members of Congress, to support your company's position, and you win. So they started adopting, for the first time, political campaign-like strategies to lobbying. They did use their relationships on Capitol Hill, but they also said, hey, maybe we can get constituents and regular voters to weigh in on issues. And so for the first time, they started sort of employing more modern tactics of using grassroots and using grass tops to impact a member of Congress. For example, they had a big issue with the Department of Commerce at one point, and instead of just going and meeting with the head of the Department of Commerce, who they knew, they said, let's go get the CEOs of these companies and have them call. And that ended up being very effective because the Department of Commerce believed more in what the companies were saying than the lobbyists.
They played hardball. Were they good at their jobs?
They were the best. I mean, in the 1980s, Black, Manafort & Sohn was the firm. They represented all the big corporate clients, all the big titans of business, Carl Icahn, Rupert Murdoch, even Donald Trump. Donald Trump's first lobbyist was Paul Manafort.
And was this when he testified about tribal gaming, that disaster that you chronicle in the book?
Correct.
That's so funny. Tell us about that.
Sort of sad and funny. So Donald Trump obviously was ran casinos and gambling, places, hotels in New Jersey. And he saw threats coming from Indian gaming. The government was making it legal for Indian tribes to have gaming on their reservations. And that created direct competition for Donald Trump's business. So he started testifying on Capitol Hill, trying to shut down Indian gaming. And in his famous testimony in the late 80s, he used much of the talk that he uses now, sort of complaining about the race of some of these Indian tribes, saying that they didn't look like Indians to him, so they probably weren't Indians, and really used some like racist language.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just the racism. It was the impetuousness. It was, he didn't like being made to cool his heels for 2 hours. And even if you examine his complaints, they don't look like Indians. I don't think they're Indians. And it was kind of shocking to the members of Congress, one or two of whom said they have never in all their years in public office had to deal with a guy like that, which is a sentiment that has become quite common when interacting with Donald Trump. But he even said, they're making fools of us, which is just a go-to for his. And there it was. As a client of Black Manafort and Stone, but he went off script and they were embarrassed by how he comported himself that day, right?
Exactly right. It's so interesting when we went back and read that testimony, you think it's something he said last week, not, in the late 1980s. But yes, one of Black Manafort and Stone's lobbyists, a guy named Scott Pastrick, was sitting behind Donald Trump during his testimony. And he was so outraged and so disgusted about what his client was saying that in the middle of the hearing, he just got up and walked out.
And we will continue our conversation tomorrow as we discuss Paul Manafort, extremism, and what, if anything, can be done to keep lobbyists in check.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. In Kristi Noem shot her dog news, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem shot her dog Cricket, that we all know. Today on Newsmax, she explains why she took the brave steps she did.
And it tells a lot of vulnerable stories of my life, of tough decisions that I've had to make over time. And I know that a lot of the liberals are, and even some Republicans and some Democrats are attacking me over a story that was in there. And literally, Eric, the whole decision was 20 years ago. It was choosing between the safety of my little kids and the public and protecting them. Versus a dangerous animal that was killing livestock and attacking people. And so
we salute your vulnerability, Governor. But there was another beast felled that day, and we got the inside details on Inside Edition.
The same day she shot Cricket, she also shot her family's pet goat. She writes that the goat was nasty and mean, chased her kids, and smelled rancid. So, just like Cricket, she dragged the goat to the same gravel pit and shot him. But the goat survived the wound, so she went back to her truck, retrieved another shell, then hurried back to the gravel pit and put him down.
So why is no one talking about the goat? Well, joining us now in Kristi Noem Shot Her Dog News, a special guest. It is the ghost of Kristi Noem's former goat, Nibbles. Take it away, Nibbles.
Bah, boo, bah, I'm a goat ghost. Pick a lane, I'm going with goat. I've got a funny joke about that. Man is in a church in Scotland. Oh, wait, I may have ruined the punchline. Anyway, I am Nibbles, or I was. When I was alive, they never gave me a name. I was always that goat. Where's the goat? Where's the smelly old goat? Let me ask you a question, Governor. How does a goat get rancid? Who's that on? Cricket, he got a name. Right now, there are several RIP Cricket Instagram pages. I'm sure people are going to be waving signs at every Kristi Noem rally till the end of time. RIP Cricket. And what does Nibbles get? Nibbles gets a spot on a B-list podcast.
Now, Nibbles.
I'm sorry. It's just that we goats, we always get the shit end of the stick. Not that we wouldn't eat that too. But it really gets my me. You use our name to describe greatness. The goat is the greatest of all time. But when you roast your goat, it means Kevin Hart makes a joke about a football player. When we get roasted, we're eaten and served with chutney sauce. Goats are mocked and trolled, and when a goat gets trolled, it really consumes us. But that's a bridge too far. But worse than trolled, we members, brave members of the goat community, we get ignored. We get overlooked. Oh, Cricket. Poor Cricket. R.I.P. Cricket. Well, what about Nibbles? There's no R.I.P. Nibbles. It's Shag Nibbles. What's Shag? It means shoot him. He's a goat. Yes, that's spelled not with two A's, but two H's. Still, it's pronounced Shag in the goat accent. Sure, you use us for your yoga. I hope it's relaxing to you. But to us, your backs are just the world's lumpiest promontories. I've stepped on more Becky and Craigs than Rocky Craigs. It is humiliating. And I gotta say, goats are known for eating anything, but I cannot believe what the Christy Gnome fans are being asked to swallow. Talk about rancid. It's enough to make a billy goat puke. Take it from someone who is actually sure-footed. You stepped in it. I say take your political aspirations to the gravel pit. I'll be here waiting in animal heaven. Cricket is here. The chickens Cricket ate, they're here. Sir Feathers, Colonel Doodle-Doo, they're all here. It's a great place. There's plenty of food. There's open air. Very important, you're not allowed in, and no yoga ever.
That was Nibbles, the ghost of Christy Gnome's goat. And that's it for the show today. Stay tuned for the end of the credits if you're a Pesca Plus subscriber to hear Nibbles' joke. Corey Wara is The Gist's producer, Joel Patterson, The Gist's senior producer. Michelle Pesca walked in on me as I was practicing this bit and said, "Your job is vastly different from mine." To advertise, you know, to get your product next to quality content like that, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oomproo, gee-proo, doo-proo, and thanks for listening.